Welcome to today's Voices of Conservation Science. On this podcast, we talk to people doing science that's then used to conserve natural resources. And I'm your host, Andrea Litt. My guest today in our studio Zoom, where we continue to hang out, is Sean Hoy Skubick, a master's student at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology. Welcome, Sean. Thanks for taking the time to visit with us.
Thanks for having me on today.
I'm excited to talk about your research, but I want to start out by just having you give us a brief introduction to our listeners.
Sure. So as you mentioned, my name is Sean Hoy Skubick. I grew up in Worcester, Ohio. I did my undergrad at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, where I received an undergrad degree in biology. And I also spent several years there working at the Vassar Farm and Ecological Preserve. After my graduation, I spent 4 years working for the USGS in Moab, Utah, studying the effects of climate change, livestock production, and mining activity on ecosystem health before coming up to Bozeman to start my master's program.
Well, you just took us on quite the ride there from Ohio all the way out to the West and jumping around a few places all the way here to the present. So I want to back up and talk about a few of those things along the way. And eventually we'll get to talking about the research that you're doing now here in Bozeman and in Montana. Growing up in Ohio, tell me where is Worcester, Ohio? What part?
So Worcester, Ohio is about an hour south of Cleveland. It's a city of 26,000 people, mostly surrounded by cornfields.
Excellent. So pretty small, a little bit different than some of the other places that you mentioned going to live eventually. And Vassar is where?
It's in Poughkeepsie, New York, in the Hudson Valley of New York. So a couple hours north of New York City, technically still part of the NYC metropolitan area.
Okay, huge shift. What brought you on that path to Vassar, and how did you pick that place, and what made that exciting for you as such a big change?
So actually, it was tennis that brought me to Vassar. I played tennis in high school and decided I wanted to play in college. And my mom's rule for me going to college was I either had to be near my parents or near family. And I've got a lot of family in the Northeast, and so I knew I wanted to get out of Ohio, so I went and looked around at a lot of D3 schools that I knew I'd be able to play tennis at, and as soon as I visited Vassar, I just fell in love. It's consistently ranked top 10 in the most beautiful campuses, and so that was a huge draw, and then the tennis coach was great, and I just fell in love.
So I assume it delivered on how beautiful the campus was when you got there?
It sure did. Yeah, it was just incredible.
And tennis, is that still something that's part of your life all these years later?
Not nearly as much anymore. You know, going into college, I hadn't discovered the passion for ecology I have now. And so tennis was my main thing. And I've developed a lot more interests. And, you know, after college, I lived in Moab for 4 years, and town of 5,000 in Utah. There's not as many people to play tennis with there, so I've taken quite a break. But being in Bozeman's nice. I've played in a couple tournaments since being here, so that's been great.
Oh, interesting. You mentioned not finding your passion for ecology until later, and so what was it that helped you find that as your passion?
Sure. Yeah. So I actually, going into my undergrad, I was thinking of either majoring in physics and astronomy or chemistry, just because what's really drawn me to science is always the allure of the unknown, all those mysteries. And so, you know, the deep cosmos, nothing's more mysterious than that. But I wanted to make sure I was going the right direction freshman year. So I took classes in all sorts of different things, from neuroscience to philosophy to economics. And I really just loved everything I learned. And so what I figured was, you know, if I love learning about all these different topics, how can I, you know, best use my skills to make the world a better place? And so that's what drove me. And so the biggest threat that we're facing as humanity is climate change. And so I wanted to be able to do something about that. And, you know, there are a couple different routes you can go with that, either a more political environmental science side, environmental policy, but I'm not a politician. I'm a scientist. And so I went with biology and went from there. Yeah.
I love that you're dabbling in all these different kinds of sciences. And you talk, you know, essentially about your curiosity, right? That allowed you to, you know, maybe be interested in so many different kinds of science, just this the learning part and the discovery part and the mysterious part. And you're thinking about some pretty deep questions between the cosmos and then climate change. I mean, those are pretty sizable questions that could be really pretty daunting, but somehow you decided that wasn't so daunting and that you could parlay that into a career. And I'm curious, you know, what helped you not be completely bowled over by such big questions and thinking, yeah, I'm gonna head right towards that huge, daunting unknown.
Yeah. So like I said, that's always what drew me to science. So I didn't view it as daunting at all. I drew it as, you know, what was exciting about it. And I think, you know, I firmly believe that everyone is born a scientist. We're all curious about the world. We all, you know, as a kid, you want to know what makes the sun glow, what makes the sky blue. You want to know all these things. And fortunately, I have scientists for parents. And so they did a really good job of instilling in me, you know, keep asking those questions and try and figure out the answers. And then once you find out those answers, ask more questions and figure out more answers. And that's how I interact with the world still today. And so
I love that. I love that because you're absolutely right. As kids, we are absolutely full of boundless questions and we look to our parents or other people to answer those questions, but then we just ask more. And I think that continuing of, like you said, the answers beget more questions and on and on and on, you know, is obviously so essential to what we do, to continue to be curious and not, there's not an end point basically ever, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's a Neil deGrasse Tyson quote that I really like. And I don't know if he was paraphrasing another scientist or not, but the quote is, as our sphere of knowledge grows, so too does the perimeter of our ignorance.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And I think and on one hand, it's really very comforting to me to think the more I know, the more I realize how little I know or how much I don't know. But yeah, I'm glad that you weren't daunted by that thought either, just like you weren't daunted by these big questions. You know, you mentioned your parents being scientists. What kind of scientists are they?
So my dad is an agricultural scientist. He started out, he was an entomologist doing crop pest research when I was a kid. And now he's kind of incorporated bigger questions and looks at sustainable agroecosystem management and food networks. So that's, you know, another massive daunting question. So maybe I had some inspiration from him. And then my mom is a molecular biologist doing GMO research.
Yeah, really, really cool. And obviously going in very different directions in terms of size, you know, your mom thinking about the molecular things. It's very cool. I assume that they were pretty instrumental in you moving in this along this path.
Yes, definitely. I mean, they got me out camping and hiking and all that stuff. So I've always loved nature. And we had a small little woods in our backyard growing up with a little stream going through it. So I would spend my childhood just looking under rocks and all that good stuff.
Seeing what you just could discover.
Yeah.
Were there other people that were really important in your development and your path and you figuring out that this was not only fun things to do in your backyard, but a path for you, for your career?
Yeah. So my grandfather played a very important role in that. He was just a very inspiring guy and always looking at how he could make the world a better place. And so when I was, I think a freshman in high school, I was, you know, had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And so he asked me the question, what's the biggest problem facing the world, and what can you do about it? And that's, I've always kept that question in my mind as I've gone through and made choices along my career path.
Wow, that's, again, a big question. And again, one that seems like it was not a daunting one to you, but one that you really used as your, perhaps as your North Star as you moved forward, which is, I'm very impressed by this. You mentioned earlier, and there was a lot of things in your intro bit that I wanted to go back to. And you mentioned the Vassar Farm, and that was how that was important in your development as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about the farm and maybe why it was so important and useful to you?
Yeah, definitely. So Vassar College has a 497 acre farm and ecological preserve. And it was started as, it was all a farm back in the early 1900s when Vassar was an all girls school. And so there are all these just incredible pictures of the women of Vassar out in their dresses in the fields, you know, tilling the fields, harvesting the crops. And it's truly something incredible. But there wasn't as much of a need for that size and the funds to manage it just weren't there. And so I forget what year, but at some point most of it was turned into an ecological preserve. There's still a small farm that supports community agriculture and goes to local food shelters and that sort of thing. But it's mostly just natural open space for protecting biodiversity and promoting learning about conservation. So it's a just invaluable research for, you know, students to come and have labs out there. And so the summer between my sophomore and junior years, I was offered a job there, and my job was just incredible. And it ranged from, you know, trail management to planting trees to planning science to collecting data to analyzing the data. So I was really just involved in all aspects of ecology, which was just so incredible to
wow, and it's such an early stage of your an undergraduate career too, to be going from start to finish of the data collection all the way to the analysis and writing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And so you did that for several months?
Yeah, so that started as just a summer position, and then I was on work study, and so it became my job through the school year as well. And so I spent a total of 2 years working at the ecological preserve.
Wow, that's a really cool thing to have in your arsenal as an undergraduate. And I'm guessing that was pretty important to help you get to these next jobs that you got after college.
Definitely,
you mentioned being in Moab and I forget the other place that you talked about, but tell us maybe a little bit about at least one of those jobs.
Yeah. So after undergrad, I, you know, applied for just everything I could, you know, trying to figure something out. And it was the SCA that I got a job with, Student Conservation Association, which was actually started by a Vassar student in as her senior thesis back in, I think, the 50s, maybe late 40s. And so I actually got to meet her, Liz Putnam, just an incredible, important figure in conservation. And so anyway, I got a job with the Student Conservation Association working for the BLM in Grand Junction, looking at sage grouse habitat assessment. And then from there, it was kind of an easy jump. I got all sorts of experience with plants and ecosystems in the Colorado Plateau through that job. And so it was an easy jump from there over to Moab, where I was working with the USGS.
It's some really pretty places that you got to spend time and in making that jump from the east side of the country to the west side of the country, and from working at this Vassar farm to these different other positions. And it sounds like between, you know, the great models that your parents set for you about being curious, and your grandfather, and then seeming like pretty easily figuring out your path. It sounds pretty smooth sailing, but
yeah, honestly, I've been so impressed and so fortunate. I feel, yeah, just incredibly lucky for how easily things have just kind of fallen into place. And the river has just taken me on.
and clearly that was not just easy. I mean, sure, very much due to your hard work and all the great experiences that you had gained. And like you talked about working at the farm and being able to take a project from data collection to analysis to the end. And then, yeah, you being able to string together multiple jobs. So not to suggest that it wasn't a result of your very, very hard work. We've talked a lot on this podcast about people's hurdles or the bumps that in the road that they've hit along the way. And sometimes you hear about people's paths and it sounds really smooth sailing and like it's a piece of cake. And obviously it was a lot of hard work. Did you hit bumps along the way or like you said, did the, based on your hard work and opportunities, were you able to sort of move through from one thing to the next without too many hurdles?
Yeah, I really haven't experienced too many hurdles, which again, I feel just so incredibly fortunate for. But yeah, like you said, it does come down to how hard I've worked. And, you know, at each of those places, at each of those steps along the way, you know, I'm passionate about what I do. And so I think that comes through. And so people are, you know, they realize, oh, he's passionate about ecology. And so I think that has kind of propelled me forward.
Yeah,
so that's really what's facilitated that.
The curiosity that sparked things so long ago, it obviously is a really great source of fuel to keep you engaged, to keep you motivated, to keep you excited, and obviously to do a really good job as you move from job to job.
Yeah, definitely.
You're listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science. And today I'm talking with Sean Hoy Skubic, and he's a graduate student at Montana State in the Department of Ecology. Sean, I want to switch gears from your really interesting path to get to this place to what you're working on now. So maybe the place to start is to tell us a little bit about the species that you're working on, and then we'll talk about exactly what you're focused on for that species, those species.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm doing tree physiology research here. And so it's a greenhouse and lab-based study primarily. And so the three species I'm focused on are all high elevation five-needle conifers. So there's white bark pine, which has huge conservation implications. It's just been listed as threatened by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then there's limber pine and great basin bristlecone pine. And so all three of these species are just incredibly long-lived. Great Basin Bristlecone Pine can live up to 5,000 years.
Wow.
Limber pine's a much relatively shorter lived, only 500 to 1,000 years. But
only.
And yeah, like white bark will take 50 years to reach sexual maturity. And so if you think about those lifespans in terms of the rapid climate change that we're seeing today, you know, that's so much change that they'll have to deal with in their lifetimes.
And you mentioned that they live at high elevations. And so these are species that, like you said, are long-lived, but I'm guessing the conditions there are pretty tough to,
yes,
to be a tree at really high elevations. And so the physiology you talked about is helping understand how they make a living, basically,
in
really tough places, and how maybe it's even getting tougher, like you said, with climate change.
Yeah, so these trees are, you know, pretty renowned for their ability to deal with just incredibly harsh conditions, and that's what makes them so important, which is what makes this research important, because they're able to establish in incredibly harsh sites, exposed, high elevation, howling winds, tops of mountains, where no one else would be able to establish. They're known as foundational species. And so they are able to establish, and then communities will establish around them and promote biodiversity through that mode.
So really important species, because of the other species that, you know, either colonize after them or rely on them perhaps for food or other things. Really long-lived, threatened for lots of reasons, including climate change. So tell us about the questions that you're focused on for these really important and imperiled species.
Yeah, so what I'm looking at is I'm inducing stress for our seedlings and looking at how these seedlings respond to climate-induced stress, such as extreme cold, heat, and drought stress. And then what I'm looking for is patterns in their physiology that correspond with high degrees of stress resistance. Because for whitebarks especially, we're seeing incredible levels of mortality due to climate change. And then also, you may have heard about mountain pine beetle and white pine blister rust. So those are huge threats. And so whitebark is seeing just incredible levels of mortality. And one of the primary restoration strategies for dealing with that mortality is outplanting seedlings into these areas where we've seen that mortality. And so if you can plant seedlings that have a higher chance of success, that's going to be beneficial to everyone. And so what I'm looking at in my research is, can we find patterns of resistance to climate-induced stress so that we can identify seedlings that will have a greater chance of persistence?
So you mentioned all these different stressors on these plants, these threats to these plants, and you're focused on the climate-related ones, the heat, the cold, the drought,
yes.
Knowing that they also have these other stresses that they may have to deal with, which is disease and insect infestations and the bark beetles and the blister rust. But tackling one source of these problems to make them, to see if there's, I'm getting this right, seedlings that are better able to survive. So when they get planted out in the world, maybe they've got a little more of a fighting chance against the other things that are all the things that are going to plague them.
Exactly. And they are all interconnected. It's not like it's just climate, because if you drought stress a plant, they're going to have less resources available to deal with those insect and fungal attacks by those vectors. And so it is all connected. Like I said, you have less resources available for defense if you're just trying to survive.
You kind of think of it as, I assume, like people, right? If you start to get a little bit sick and then you get exposed to something else, it's just going to be that much harder to fight off whatever the next thing might be.
Yeah. Or if you're sleep deprived, not eating well,
right. Just generally stressed.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier that this is you're doing this work in the greenhouse and in the lab. So maybe you tell us a little bit about how you go about doing this really important work.
Yeah, so we've got 17 populations of these three species in the greenhouse, both 2, 3, and 5-year-old individuals.
So collected from these populations in the field.
Yeah, so there's 17 genetic source materials that were all grown on a common lot in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and then donated to us by the Forest Service.
And so you bring those into the greenhouse or into the lab, and what happens next?
So we have growth chambers in the greenhouse and growth room, so we can manipulate the temperature that way and manipulate how much water they're receiving in the greenhouse. And so you can do that either for a whole plant or with some of the heat and cold stress research we do, you just expose certain tissues to that. So I just got finished last weekend with some extreme cold research. And so I would just take a few needles, put them in a little test tube, put them in this freezer that can go down to -70°C. And so you drop that and to an extreme cold temperature and then see what sort of damage the cell membranes and the photosynthetic machinery has incurred through that.
Oh, wow. So yeah, at all these different scales, you start looking at the whole organism and all the parts.
Yes.
Very cool.
So there's lots of different parts, different scales you can look at. And so I'm interested in kind of whole plant level dynamics. And so I'll be looking at one of the main responses to these stresses that we're going to be inducing in the greenhouse that I'll be looking at will be, how are these trees allocating their carbon under conditions of stress?
So if you had to boil down into a little short nugget, why would you say your research is important? Clearly you said that the trees themselves are important, but tell us why what you're focused on is important.
So physiology is how organisms interact with their environment. And so if we can understand what's going on at the physiological level, we can understand and predict what's going to happen at the ecosystem level, because that is a direct scale that the physiology acts as an interface. And so we can know if we see these shifts in the environment because of what's going on at the physiological level, we'll see these changes in the community and the population.
And how do you imagine that your work would be used on the ground once you've wrapped up your project?
Yeah, so there's two main ways that my project can be used. The first way is improving predictions of future vegetation dynamics. And so that kind of gets at what I was just talking about with physiology determining what's going on at both for the individual and then scaling that up to the ecosystem level. And so if we have better understanding of what's going on with these trees' physiology, we can make better predictions for what future dynamics under climate change will look like. The other implication will be improving conservation strategies. So that gets back to what I was talking about with the outplanting of seedlings for restoration. And so if we can understand and have some sort of marker to look for trees that exhibit this physiological marker will have greater degrees of stress resistance, we can put more investment into those in restoration.
But, and that seems like a really important piece, because what you talked about first was it's going to help you understand and predict what might happen. But this restoration piece is sort of your way to do something about that and not just predict what's going to happen and have to watch it happen, however exactly negative it might be. And that's got to be really exciting to be involved in something that really could be really, really important for the conservation and restoration of these important species.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that was super important to me when I was thinking about what that next step was before coming here, was that I did want my research to have some sort of application like that, where here's how this will make an impact.
Is that the best thing that you could discover when you fast forward to the end, is finding some populations of these plants that are going to better withstand stress and could be planted in the environment? Or can you imagine something even more exciting?
No, I think that's best case scenario. Yeah.
Yeah, that seems pretty important and pretty best thing to me. Shall we wrap up these interviews with our freebie, maybe wild card question is a better thing, because sometimes answering this question is actually pretty challenging. And that is, what's your favorite animal or your favorite plant? Or we'll even let you pick one of each if you have one.
Okay. So my favorite plant, I'm not going to go with a type of plant. I'm going to go with an individual plant, which is the purple beech that lives in the chapel lawn at Vassar. And I just...
Oh, that's very, very specific.
Such a connection to that tree. As an undergrad, I spent so much time in that tree. I would take naps in it. I would hang out in it. I would read in it. I would go there to think and just climb around in the branches. And so I have a very special connection with that tree.
That's really cool, because obviously you're studying trees. So describe what a purple beech looks like in general? And maybe, is it the location of this particular one, or is it something about its look?
It's something about how the branches are structured. So this particular beech has very low branches that go straight out. And so you can just set up your hammock in them. You can lounge on them like a leopard, or, you know, it's also got just the perfect branches for climbing and getting way up into the top of the tree. So that's really what it was about that.
That sounds amazing.
And I've kind of always had a favorite tree. Like growing up, we had another tree in my backyard that I would spend all my time in, just climbing around and hanging out in. So that's been a theme through my life.
Have you gone to these high elevation places where your seedlings came from, the source material where they came from? And if you have, I'm curious if it's time for you to find another favorite tree in one of these high elevation places, it would seem.
It definitely is time for me to find one. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance. I haven't had a chance yet. You know, I moved up to Bozeman last summer and just really got jumped right in. And so hopefully this summer I'll have more of a chance to explore and get up to those high elevations and check things out.
You have time to have time to find the next favorite individual tree and not just tree species. I do love this because I also can imagine certain trees in my childhood that had the perfect branches for just getting up in there or a perfect flat spot to sit and read a book or whatever it is. So I can really
these are wonderful things.
Yeah. And I love that your journey with trees continues, and that's great. Thanks so much, Sean, for taking the time to talk with me today and to share your journey and your passion for all things science, all things ecology, and all things trees. I really wish you good luck with your research and your work here at Montana State University, the beginning of this latest part of your path. And I'm excited to hear how it resolves with this high potential for cool restoration outcomes.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciated the opportunity to share.
And thanks to you all for listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review or share it with a friend. We'd also love it to hear from you. You can send us your thoughts about the podcast, or you can send questions for our guests at todaysvoices@montana.edu. And you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.